Jim Joyce made it another week. Made it another week.
This is our hey. Another week. This is
oh man,
week four of the. I was calling it the revitalization. Play it, baby. Play it.
Yeah, play it. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I completely forgot that we meticulously. I don't know. I love this tune. I'm gonna listen to it all the time.
Exactly. I think we should get it professionally linked in there so we can get that right. People are asking. People asking me for the tune. They like the tune. You know.
Well, you know what I love about our meticulously unproduced is that not that you have too much time on your hands, but you have just a little more than you used to.
100%.
And I love all of a sudden I'm seeing these shorts, YouTube shorts. So for our listeners, first of all, I'm Eugene Borahovich, and I'm a co-host at The Shot of Digital Health Therapy. Welcome, Jim.
Excellent. Well done. And Jim Joyce here. And actually the co-host here, the shorts are phenomenal. Like I've the two cuts that I did from our last two guests was the as act as if.
Yeah,
from
yeah,
Dave
yeah,
Griffiths, yeah. Which I love.
Great.
I love that. You know, just excellent. And then the other was Never Waste a Crisis. So from Sana, which is just perfect.
Amazing. Love it.
Well, actually, I've listened to it because I did the shorts. I listened back to it a few times, and I'm using them. I want to go back and cut all the other guests in the past and see if we can get, because there's loads of wisdom over the last years.
Oh yeah. We talked about it, right? We can get our magic AI. But let's fly through. I know people are kind of tuning in, and you know what are we watching? We're not watching much, but I did see if another my LinkedIn feed was full with Walmart Health shutting down.
Big
you
news.
Know, and Matthew Holt, shout out, he did a nice little write-up and a post. You know, I think a lot of this was Cheryl Pegus was a visionary trying to bring this together. Others commented, well, it's try number 6 or 5 or whatever for Walmart. And the question is, can these big giants really make an impact, especially more kind of primary care and the cost structure? So that's the one I'm tracking. I saw, well, not tracking, but at least what showed. So,
and what's your take? What's your twist on it versus what Matthew was saying?
Honestly, I believe it or not, I actually kind of agree with Matthew. I mean, it's you know, I think a lot of the executives in large organizations have cycles, right? It's X number of years. I think it starts out with great initiative, great thought process, great, you know, moving forward. The question is, how do you scale it? How do you scale the operations? Are they profitable? Because ultimately,
how do they compete with the big system,
call it poor business, and one would argue, you know, Walmart is in the corner, but. The other one, not calling it yet, but, you know, our friend Eddie Martucci and Achille, I know he kind of stepped back to the board, but I did see the press release that they're looking at other options. They kind of fast forwarded their deal with a Japanese pharma company to kind of, I think, forego royalties and get some cash in. Cost reduction. So I've always used Achille is probably the shining light in the digital therapeutics market as a
and Eddie is fantastic.
We'll
see what's going on. Hopefully that, you know, that can, if they explore that, hopefully that technology can find, you know, it's clever, it's useful, there's huge amounts of investment, so hopefully they'll get something. They'll make progress somehow with that.
Yeah, I know, you know, we were just kind of chatting, what's the good news out there? And that's part of the reason why I try not to watch the news, because there's almost nothing ever. I am tracking Jessica Yellen. I don't know if anybody's following her on Instagram. She used to be a CNN reporter. Like, it's news, not noise. I literally, for real, you know, not digital health news. I follow her and that's it. So, but anything you found interesting?
You know, the only thing I was picking up that I was going to mention was that I saw in the Financial Times this weekend that the giant outsourcing organization, Tata Consultancy, which outsources like almost to every industry, obviously healthcare amongst them, but lots of other industries. And they talked about that there's going to be a minimal need for call centers within a year, you know, based on what's happening in artificial intelligence. So that's, you know, for an organization that makes its living off of building call centers is a pretty powerful thing. So just thinking about the impact to healthcare, because healthcare obviously is, is loaded with call center activities and onboarding and this kind of touch everywhere.
Well, look, I don't remember who they partner up with, but NVIDIA also talked that there's a foreseeable future for $9 an hour nurses, right? Via AI. Now, again, we have our own hypothesis that it will be a yes, and a yes. I think there's a place for all of these.
Sure.
And I think humans will continue staying in the loop. Let's jump right in. I'm going to let in our newly found friend, Michael. So Michael is joining us, I think, from New Jersey, but he will correct us. Michael, good afternoon. You are joining us from New Jersey, right? Am I correct?
I am from New Jersey. That's right.
Okay.
Hey, Michael.
You're coming in. Michael, Jim, Michael.
Pleasure to meet.
Great to meet you, Jim.
Can you just let's, because we're meticulously
check the mic.
Produced, let's do the mic checking thing a little bit. You're coming in pretty low.
That might be better. I think it was.
Oh, yeah.
There we go.
Much better. And
we get it.
Got music on in the background.
right from the Garden State to Dublin, Ireland, right back to Charlotte where you are, right? We got the sound moving through.
That's it.
Exactly. Well, welcome to the shot, Michael. I know you and I connected on LinkedIn, I think after our mutual friend Dave Kerrigan was on in the last season, which we just, by the way, switched from seasons to just let's keep going. We are on, this will be episode 138. So yeah, and then I know you and I had a call and loved what you're doing. It's an interesting role, but we always want to get to know the person on the screen, at least at some point face to face. So as some of these things we kick off, take us through your journey wherever you want to start. We can start at 2 years old or
Well, let's see, I've spent 30 years in healthcare and benefits, so I think that's long enough to be a lifetime.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because I feel like at every step of the way, I've tried to be on the leading edge of some innovation in my various different roles. And they just keep, pulling the rug out from under me or moving the goalposts, whatever you want to call it, because healthcare is hard, right? Like at the end of the day. But I started out in healthcare, working for a local Blue Cross Blue Shield organization in New Jersey. And what was fun about that is I was selling an HMO at a time in the early 90s when HMOs were a thing and people thought it was going to change healthcare. And so within 1 year of doing that, my organization got folded into a larger Blues organization and they thought that I had some level of expertise that I didn't have, right? It was managed care was the thing and you must know all about it. So that's going to, help us change the way we do indemnity programs. And that led to point of service programs and the thing. But from there, I went on to United Healthcare and had early innovation roles and actually helping to build out some of the earliest retiree exchanges. And I learned a lot through failure in some of the earliest iterations that we put out there. But it is nice to see that has actually progressed and we've seen, how that kind of business model evolved. And then from there, I went into the health and well-being space in an earlier stage company and, really was focused on thought that disease management was going to be the thing that was going to help fix everybody and solve, the medical cost issues. And we saw how that turned out, right? And from there, I moved on into another startup, which was in the advocacy and navigation space. And, at the time we were doing it, my role was the chief evangelist. Like I was out there selling the idea that people needed a healthcare navigation solution. They needed a personal health assistant. And that concept didn't exist, 10 plus years ago when I started. But now you see it as kind of commonplace today. So I've been part of that journey in the last, 10 plus years have been in the consulting space. And at LockedIn, I lead the Insights and Innovation Lab. So we're all about, developing market insights, looking at leading edge solutions, helping to evaluate and measure those solutions and essentially prove the value or not, so that our clients can make better investments.
Fascinating journey, but also sounds, I don't want to say depressing. We're just talking, you know, we usually kind of chat for a couple of minutes in the beginning, Jim and I. We're talking about, well, we didn't even mention the Optum virtual care shutting down, you know, Walmart shutting down, and all of these great initiatives that seem great. You know, I've had the DTX podcast for how many years, and that was the shining light. And I always asked, you know, well, why can't you kind of self-treat after the prescription, right? So, and all of these things. So what have you seen in the 30 years that worked? Maybe before we dive deeper into kind of your role, sounds fascinating and would love to learn more, but.
Yeah, so the things that still were true back then, I think are true today, which is that there is still the need for that primary care coordination. And so what's happened, I think, is we've had this, we constantly go through these changes of expansion and contraction in healthcare. And for the last 10 years or so, the digital health expansion led to lots and lots of point solutions, but it led to greater fragmentation. And I think the thing that we're coming back to is my earliest days in the HMO world of saying, hey, let's make sure that there's a clinical quarterback who oversees all of the individual needs, connect them to digital health, connect them to all of the available services that are out there, behavioral health integration, like those are the critical things, but integrate around a primary care experience rather than, you know, the way that it's been done over the years, which is the health plan experience.
And Michael, just to kind of bookend for our millions of visitors here. So are you originally from New Jersey, or would you, you know, maybe we take us back a little bit to baby Michael?
Yeah, I'm a New Englander. So I actually grew up in Massachusetts and went to college at the University of New Hampshire. And so I grew up in the Berkshires of Western Mass. And my wife is the reason that brought me to New Jersey, but I like to say everybody spends time in New Jersey. So at one point or another, you'll be here.
It's fascinating that you,
it's the Garden State. The Garden State.
Yeah, my first son was born in Hoboken, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And I had an epic road trip from Fordham University to UNH that I still think about fondly.
Well, we could go off for days on that.
But so you grew up in, and what did you study at UNH?
Yeah, I was an English major. So my focus was not healthcare, believe it or not. It was not even insurance. So that was just an interesting twist in kind of how I ended up there.
It's funny. My family makes fun of me that I don't speak any language perfectly, because English is my second language, but I also don't speak Ukrainian, a little bit of, you know, still speak Russian just because I grew up in there, but also not perfect. So, Michael, you'll help me edit the notes for this later.
Yeah. You'll appreciate, at least I took Russian in college. A year of Russian because I was taking Russian literature at the time. And so I had to be able to speak it and read it, which was a challenge.
That's awesome.
Wow.
Well, the joke we always say is that the Irish and the Americans are divided by a common language. So that's a consistent.
Exactly.
Michael, it's interesting, right? Because I've, you know, as we're sort of discovering kind of the whole employer market, and, you know, you keep hearing, to be frank, I haven't heard about Lockton until recently, until kind of you and I connected. And actually spoke to a colleague of yours, John O'Connor from Midwest. So he knows you this morning, but so shout out to another Irishman, by the way. But, you know, maybe talk to us and to our listeners, you know, kind of people, you know, there's consultants, there's brokers, how you're looking at this, right? And obviously, you know, many employers are relying on you broadly, Lockton, but just curious how you look at this.
Yeah, I think, you know, in my prior roles at Willis Towers Watson, I was a consultant. And, you know, I think Lockton is a consultancy firm as well. I think it's really about client size segments and how you get compensated that sometimes, you know, people get caught up in that. But certainly in the mid-market where Lockton does a lot of our business, in the smaller ends of the market where it's fully insured benefits, those are often brokerage relationships, right? There's some kind of commission payment that's attached to a premium. For the vast majority of the other relationships, there's a core set of services that you're providing, and it's essentially a fee-for-service relationship. you're doing standard actuarial work, you're doing all kinds of analysis for the client, and you're helping them with vendor selection. Those are the same whether you call yourself a broker or consultant. I think some of it, you know, as the clients get larger, the projects get larger, and the scope of those projects are a little more differentiated. But I don't see a real meaningful distinction there that I call out. You know, it's really about the client segments.
And if you, and just to kind of, for some of the people, like we have lots of people listening from the US, like maybe just like even like a big picture locked in, you know, okay, yes. what part of the healthcare system do you guys dominate, or for the 101?
Yeah. Well, the other thing to recognize too is Lockton has really two sides. There's the business risk side, which is, you know, the property casualty side of the risk. And then there's the employee benefits, or what we call the people solution side. And so we're managing that people risk, if you will. And so within that, we are a global organization and we have 10,000 employees across the globe, vast majority again in the US. But, you know, we work with several thousand employers that are in the, let's say, 500 to 5,000 segment. And then we have, you know, at least 100 employers that are more than 10,000 lives. And this, again, you know, what we do for them and the services we provide will vary based on those contracts. But essentially, you know, helping them with plan decisions every year and going through that process of trying to help them save costs, simplify the administration, improve their overall employee experience and well-being. Like, those are the core tenets of what we do.
Maybe talk a little bit about, you know, your title has insights and innovation. So would love to kind of learn what are some insights that you've been seeing. And I think, you know, to me, it's like pre-COVID, post-COVID, if you will, but happy to. And then, what are some of the innovations that you're also tracking and seeing?
Yeah. As I said, we're on the leading edge to try to identify what are the trends to pay attention to. So we try to, you know, separate the noise that may be out there and really focus on those things that are going to save our customers money. You know, what can we do to really reduce cost and healthcare spend? And those are harder and harder to find, right? The costs just keep going up every year. So some of the areas that I've been spending time on recently have been around uses of AI in both HR and benefits spaces. We're focused a lot on the transparency data. So if you're aware of the machine readable files that have been made available through the health plans and the health systems, we're working with that data now through a third party to better understand market cost and variability and how that impacts our clients' utilization. And so we have a number of projects in that area. And then, you know, the other stuff that we do is really focused on the digital health space. So, you know, evaluating impact of musculoskeletal conditions or diabetes management solutions, really just trying to understand, for clients who have implemented a strategy in those areas, are they seeing different results than those that have maybe nothing in place? And what can we do with that data to drive more continuous improvement? So we're not necessarily assuming an ROI, but we are looking for measures and markers of value to say, hey, if we did more of this, or if we engage more of the right population, we might actually see better results.
And are you seeing are you seeing project scale, like digital health projects scale right now in your universe?
Well, it's interesting. You may have seen a recent report from the Peterson Health Technology Institute.
I'm just going to ask you on.
You're going to go right on right there.
Yeah,
okay.
I was just going
to
ask.
So you know, we still need to talk about Walmart and Optum telemedicine too, but because that's another hot topic, but. For me, you know, I found it really insightful to have an independent third party who could look at the data and begin to develop a framework that, you know, would give us some indications of whether or not these things are really moving the needle. I don't think any of us had an expectation that they were delivering ROI. And I think some of the negative reactions to that report are really more around the conclusion that makes it sound like these things aren't, you know, worth it. What I looked at it more is what they're saying is, they're delivering about the same as the usual standard of care. And if digital health can do that and do that in an efficient way, I think that's a good starting point, right? I don't look at that as failure. I look at that as, how do we do that and do more of it and get more of the right populations? Mm-hmm. So there were some really meaningful opportunities about engaging more, let's say, safety sensitive populations is one example. So if you have a bunch of truckers who might, you know, have diabetes, and, you know, what is the impact on safety if you avoid a diabetic event while they're on the road? Or if you have more people who are new to therapy and you're able to get those people immediately into a program, the value was there for those individuals. Or if you have more people who are above a 9 A1C and you get more of those people engaged in the program, you're going to see more value. So I think it's just saying, what do we need to do next to really target the right populations and ensure that, and this is what I mean by continuous improvement. Like, yeah, we're learning every day in this space. And I think we have to embrace that.
Before we move on to some other topics, because you say we still need to talk about Optum and Walmart. So the hot take from Michael, go.
Optum Walmart. Yeah. So fascinating, because it happened, you know, the timing of this was really interesting. And the fact that just, you know, months ago, Walmart was on their expansion plans. So I don't necessarily see this as an indictment of the virtual space either, right? Like I do think it says they couldn't figure out a way to make money. Some of that is because they don't necessarily see it translating into store visits or other types of ways that they could monetize a customer. And I think that'll be a question for Amazon in the future, right? Like, what is their strategy and how are they trying to monetize that customer? The comparison everyone's making is to CVS and their MinuteClinic strategy. And from all, you know, that we've heard, it's more similar now, or it sounds more similar to what Optum is doing in owning physician practices. And so I think that the transactional nature of the telemedicine service that Optum built was such a commodity. I thought that there was more to the clinic experience that Walmart could bring to rural communities. That's really disappointing to see that go away. But at the end of the day, I think it's just a reshifting of, you know, who's going to really own that consumer experience and sort of the last mile of engagement.
I'm actually looking for, you mentioned, you know, Amazon will be the next sort of, I don't know, milestone or checkpoint for a lot of this. I'm looking forward to, I'm heading to the ATA in Phoenix this Saturday, and I'm actually interviewing Greg, who is one of their senior leaders at One Medical. So we're doing a fireside chat. So part of this will be a question as well, kind of what they're seeing. Let's see.
So, let me know what you hear.
yeah, for sure. You know, maybe just again back to a little bit of the insights, right? I just kind of looked through the business health business group on health report that just also recently came out, and you know, no brainer, right? MSK, oncology, metabolic, which kind of GLPs are in there driving a lot of the cost, and then mental health, right? So kind of the big four. Curious what you've seen. I think you and I chatted and you said, well, there's this balloon going on. And I couldn't remember what it was regarding to, but that it made sense as I'm talking. So,
well, yeah, there's a couple of things in there, and I'll get back to that scenario in a second. But, you know, I think overall, the kinds of cost drivers that you're talking about, what's interesting is cancer has sort of moved to number one or number two for most employers, and MSK is right there, very close, one or two. And so those are the big cost drivers and issues. The solutions in that space, in the MSK space, can drive a lot of value by avoiding surgery. Like, so much of the surgery that gets done should just not happen. And I think that's still most of the bundled payment or COE type programs are great. They just don't get enough of the right people. It's back to what I was saying before about the digital health. Like, we're still in the early days of figuring out to how to educate consumers to make better choices and to use information to essentially shop for care. Let's face it, the HSAs didn't do that, right? It did not make people consumers. So we have to find another way that people actually understand and appreciate quality at a different level. So I think that's a big part of the problem to solve. And then the other thing is, those are actually, like, MSK is a pretty big percent of the population. Diabetes is a big percent. Cancer is a much smaller percent, but it has a huge impact on the people. And there in that realm, employers are really looking for more of the concierge support. Like, how do I help guide a person who's going through a terrible life event, support them, support their family? Because you're not going to save money necessarily in cancer other than trying to catch people earlier by getting the routine screenings that they should have been doing anyway. So you have to have a focus more on prevention and things like in each of these areas, as well as, you know, the back end solution when it's too late.
Just, you know, building on this, I mean, there's many solutions, and we sort of alluded to point solutions in each of the spaces. Sorry, Jim, that's the, you know, the sound in the background. That's why I actually realized I can just mute him myself. So lots of, you know, point solutions, but everything that kind of we're hearing from employers is really that activation, right? So a bit of that lack of trust. I don't even know where to go, who to turn to. So I, as an employer, might be procuring a lot of these solutions, but, you know, it's a bit of a chore to think about the enrollment season, you know, health plan, dealing with this. What are some of the things that you're seeing that's maybe working in the field, maybe not? And what are you hearing from the employers on the point solution and activations?
Yeah, certainly. I think there's an opportunity at least to leverage sort of outside in capabilities. So if you think about digital marketing and, you know, search engine optimization, like all of that stuff exists in the commercial realm that could transfer very easily into healthcare. So I've seen some really cool examples of kind of trying to redirect search from Google into a platform or a service. And I think a lot of the point solution vendors are really, you know, they're employing behavioral scientists and trying to use, you know, the best available behavioral economics, you know, approaches. But at the end of the day, we haven't cracked it. We haven't solved for the patient engagement piece. But the people who do it love it. And I think in many ways, some of the most successful programs, I'll mention Virta, they've grown through word of mouth in many ways. Now, that's a very difficult lifestyle adaptation. But for the people who do it, you know, their most famous patient has a tattoo. Like, if you have a company that's willing to, you have an individual who's willing to get a tattoo of your company logo because they changed your life, like that's impactful kind of marketing.
Hey, we had somebody wanted to print t-shirts with our logo. So, all right, we'll call up Virta and share some of the stories.
Yeah, I think you need a tattoo.
And just Michael, what's the secret? Like, I listened to, you know, like Eugene's, you know, everything about his technology and trying to get adoption engagement. But when you're going through the employer, what's the secret to getting adoption of these new technologies, you know, ones that you think add a lot of value? Everyone's committed, company's committed, seems great, but it seems like a lot of them don't get adoption eventually, like from yeah. Employers. Is there a secret?
You know, the thing that I encourage them to really work hard towards is understanding the employer's ecosystem. Like, too often the digital health solution or the innovator comes in and they've designed this great experience, and it may be designed all around the member, but it ignores sort of the central integration point, which is their day-to-day employee experience. And what are all of the other vendor partners that the employer is already working with? And some of those are just, you know, intractable barriers. When I started out in the advocacy space, the health plans wanted nothing to do with us, and they wouldn't integrate. They didn't want to share data. So breaking down some of those barriers having an employer who is willing to go to bat for you is critical to kind of getting you the access that you need to better integrate and tie those pieces together.
Speaking like, you know, as we're talking, it's funny. We went through EHIR Academy, right? Marina and I, and one of their lines was, once you meet one employer, you meet one employer. You know, I kind of say to a certain extent, it's a bit of a cop out on a statement. I think there's some of it. But I think if you look at the buckets, for lack of a better term, just from a size perspective, you got the really small, you know, SMBs, you got the mid-market, and then you got the jumbo. I think Lockton generally focuses kind of mid-market-ish, but if you got any insights for our audience, kind of what you've seen across the three buckets?
Sure. In that large employer space, you know, they do certainly have the market clout to be able to both bend, you know, the big incumbents, as well as to mold an early stage company and make them better, right? So I do see a lot of the early stage companies really trying to plant a flag with some big logo names. But you can be just as successful working with mid-market companies because they can be much more agile. You know, they're much more willing to move things off cycle or be able to, you know, do a pilot that is, you know, a bigger percentage of their total population, where you might be working with a 200,000 life employer, and you might get a pilot that's 20,000 people in a particular region. So that can be analogous to working with a mid-market employer, right? You get the whole thing and it could still be considered a pilot. And I, like I said, I just see more flexibility and ingenuity from those that are smaller. They have to be a little bit more willing to push the envelope, but they're not always going to get the cooperation that they need from the big incumbents. And I think that leads to this other just kind of market theme. I think we're moving into this phase of this anti-incumbency bias, right? Like more willing to be disruptive, more willing to make changes by moving away from the BUCAs, moving away from the big three PBMs and demanding more transparency around the cost information that's available.
And so staying with that, you know, what's happening between pharmaceutical companies and PBMs right now? Where do you see that? What's going on?
Well, yeah, it's really interesting because the big three PBMs they've sort of reacted to the Mark Cuban story. They've had to. And that's what's really interesting is he's a scrappy upstart, but he's got a huge soapbox, right? Like he can reach a consumer audience in ways that very few people can. And I think that alone, that kind of market power is causing some change to happen. And so I was at the business group on health session that you mentioned just a couple of weeks ago, and he spoke and he really, you know, put a finger in their eye and said, you know, you've been ripping employers off all these years. And what we need is just more transparency. What we need to get to is the lowest net costs of the drug. And Eugene, this gets back to what I meant by pushing on the balloon. So the example is the spread pricing that we see around generic drugs, right? The deals that were made early on from the PBMs were, they recognized that all of these new higher cost brand name drugs were coming to market and they had these really low cost generics. And so they wanted a way to smooth the cost out for the employer. And they just started pushing on this side of the balloon. We're going to push down the brand name cost, but we're going to collect a little bit more on the generic cost. So it just pops up in another place. And so now here we are, you know, 20 years later, and everyone's questioning, well, why do we have these really high generic costs when Walmart's selling it for $4? And the reality is, yeah, we've just found a way to spread the cost in different buckets. And at least if we can move towards more transparency, we can get to a better understanding of what we're paying for. And then we can negotiate around the value of those solutions. The other part of, I think, the pharmacy piece is like with the GLP-1 space, I think we're starting to see them go direct to consumer, right? So the pharmaceutical manufacturers, Lilly, Direct, standing up their own program, to be able to sell, you know, GLP-1 and have a patient experience. And there's consumer demand for those drugs. At the same time, the PBMs are hearing from their employer clients that say, hey, we can't just open up the doors here and give everyone full access to this. We want to make sure that it's appropriate, that it meets with the guidelines, and that people have a good understanding of the side effects, and that, you know, the effectiveness varies based on the individual. So just having more, and that it needs to come with some intensive lifestyle intervention. And so making sure that, you know, all of the component parts are there to deliver a better experience.
If you were to look out like in a year from now in that employer market, is it going to be a battle between employers that cover the GLP-1s and the ones that don't cover the GLP-1s, or how do you think that's going to play out?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's always been like the escalation wars that took place, I would say, always come out of the Bay Area, right? So you get sort of this need, fierce need for talent and competition for talent. And so we started to see that, let's say, in fertility benefits, and they're offering, you know, full coverage for fertility and egg freezing, and you name it, right? They just kept escalating. And so we got into this arms race around benefits. I don't know that GLP-1s impacts the same demographics and the same population the same way. And so the employers that you see kind of pushing back on this are like the state of North Carolina, or the state of Connecticut has implemented a really innovative program to try to get their arms around it, because they say, we're at the end of the day, like, our taxpayers are paying for this, and we want to make sure that it's necessary and appropriate and the right people get access to care. And so I think this is not one of those people will change jobs for it, although you may see data that says otherwise. I think it's more of an important business decision for an employer to make about, you know, what is the nature of my population and the expected impact on future healthcare costs. And today, it's not cost effective to do that.
That's where Lockton comes in with the consultancy side of it.
That's what we help people understand.
Awesome.
Well, I mean, each one of these we can go deeper and deeper into, but, you know, we as we keep mentioning almost every episode, I think people's attention start kind of winding down. So we're going to get to Jim's, you know, famous last question.
Okay. So Michael, if you can imagine yourself, you get a lovely invite in the mail to go back to your alma mater and speak at UNH. And you're talking to a group of English majors that are thinking about pursuing a career in healthcare, in the Byzantine nature of U.S. healthcare and understanding the impact of it. And one of them's listening, you see this young man in the background, and he's like, are you the guy in charge of the innovation labs at Lockton? Is this you, Michael? I can't believe I got a chance to talk with you. And you look at that young UNH graduate about to head into the world of healthcare. What's the one piece of advice you would give him as he heads off on that career?
Wow. Yeah, it's an interesting career choice, first of all, I would say. and don't go into it lightly. But, you know, I think my advice is what I would say to anyone, to take more chances, right? To stop fearing the regret of actions you might take, like, be willing to try something. And I did that throughout my career. I took the next thing because I really wanted to learn. I wanted to figure out how to optimize that instead of, you know, overanalyzing and, you know, regretting your decision to maybe not take that chance on that startup or not take that chance on that new innovative thing. So my wife and I have a mantra that's like, when you're trying to make a decision, just do the thing that scares you the most, right? Like, try to, you know, take on that risk and figure out how do you move through that and how do you learn through the process.
Jim, that perfect cut again. Love it. Perfect cut of the advice. Michael, thank you.
Take more chances.
Yeah.
Take more chances. Thank you for joining us. And to all of our listeners and viewers, hit subscribe, pass this on. And if anybody knows well Mark Cuban, we've been trying to get him on this show for years now. So
Fantastic. Sure. That was great, Michael.